You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. McNamara, Michael, as my mother calls me, used to call me, she still calls me that though, someplace, Mac to my friends, yeah, alright, let me give you an accounting update. I crushed that shit. That's right, it took me a while, so I had to do almost 3.5 years. 3.5 years of accounting. So that's what I've been working on. And last night, I reconciled all that work. I had one entry, one journal entry to make an adjustment. And I wouldn't even have to do that, but I didn't know how to do what I needed to do because the transaction, the software said, that's cleared. So you can't delete it. But it hadn't really cleared because it's an old transaction that I manually inputted, and then I screwed up the manual input. So it was a bad transaction. It was a duplicate. So for whatever reason, software says, no, this is cleared. I couldn't go delete it. So they had to make an adjusting entry. But, yeah, kaboosh. Mm-hmm. Now all I have to do is type a few loose ends. Yeah, I'm done with that shit. Oh my god. If you do that, if you're an accountant for a living, no wonder you're no fun. Right? No wonder you don't have any friends. No wonder you're a loser. Come on, man. I mean, that's my life. I go in and do this all the time. Oh, man. I don't live like that. I have way, way more fun than that. First of all, I have like drafty windows in this house that I'm renting right now in Orange County. Just go outside and recalk them. What do you do with drafty windows when, I mean, literally in my bedroom, I can hear the ambient noise from outside. You know, when you close the windows, you shouldn't really hear shit from outside. Except an explosion or gunfire should it occur on your street or maybe a street or two over. But I can hear the shh, right, that ambient noise. Right, I can hear that. And I don't hear very good. Exactly. So, yeah. So I need some advice. I need some advice on how, what's the best way to fix it, right? I don't own the home, so it's not like I'm going to replace the windows. So if you have if you're a handyman out there, let me know, right? Let me know. The I want to play a few quotes today about, I got kind of thinking about this phobia. It's not right to call it a phobia, but maybe a little bit of reluctance that people have to get involved with other people relative to mental health stuff. And so I want to play something that's kind of the intellectual basis of a lot of what I believe, as I've come to learn more about the mental health community and the revolutions going on in mental health around the country, blah, 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 blah. So Josh Goldberg told me about these Indian guys in the Indian doctors in the field of mental health that are doing work in the United States, doing studies in the United States. And I want you to listen. I want you to listen to a few minutes of it because it's at an event in Texas and where they're talking about community-based mental health. Okay? Community-based mental health. That's right. So, and I think that's important that people understand the direction of mental health. The other thing I think is important is for us not to be reluctant to talk to people about our shit, right? I mean, if you understand a little bit about the direction, because let me tell you what's happened now. You know, these kind of myths are being slayed around the world about what works. And so you're going to hear some real interesting stuff in this thing. And I use a part of it in the presentation, in the post-traumatic winning presentation. But the two Indian doctors, one's named Patel, and the other guy whose quote I use is Madagar, and I can't remember his last name. Anyway, maybe it'll be here. Yeah, it's not. The guy who's probably more famous is a PhD by the name of Vikram Patel, V-I-K-R-A-M-P-A-T-E-L. And so they talk about community-based mental health, and they're both from India, because with 1.3 billion people, they don't have enough people to help. So, you know, how do they go about it? What do they do? Well, let me just tell you something here. I want you to listen to the math, and so... So some of the things they're saying, I think, ought to dispel for us any hesitation or this thing like that I think exists in most of us saying, well, only the mental health providers know. What they're saying is, no, that ain't true. So we're going to listen to that, and I'll do commentary throughout, okay, just which I love to do. And then in hour two today, Jack Riley's going to join us. One of my favorite dudes on the planet. That's right. Jack going to bring his Alabamese dialect to Omri Radio again. And we're going to talk about, I don't know, life after Vietnam. Get his thoughts on his experience about coming home and whatnot. So yeah, one of my favorite people on the planet. And again, somebody who I've found great inspiration. If you have not listened to the interviews that I've done with Jack Riley, slap yourself, okay? R-I-L-E-Y. I met him after he listened to the interview that I did with retired General Butch Neal, former Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps, and about a fight called Getlin's Corner. I would tell you it's, I think, the most decorated fight I've ever read about. It was a five-hour fight, I think, and Medal of Honor is awarded to Lieutenant John Bobo out of it, 4 Navy crosses, 6 silver stars, and 3 bronze stars in the space of about, 5 hours. And so so I did that interview, and then what happened was he heard it, and he wrote me this awesome email, and so I emailed him back, and I said, hey, would you like to be on Omri Radio? And he said, well, I don't know. I don't rightly know. I don't rightly know. And so I called him and I said, hey, I'm Mike McNamara. And so he came on and he told General Neal was reluctant to get into the details of the fight. So we talked about his book. We talked generally about the Battle of Gettysburg's Corner. And he was, he's a little bit, I don't know. I don't know. He was reluctant. He was reluctant to talk about that stuff. And so when Jack Riley emailed me and I asked him, would you come on? He said, yeah, I'll come on. And so we did a battlefield study. And, Jack talked in detail about what happened that day. So that was my introduction. But honestly, as amazing as the story of that fight is, what he's done since he's come home is honestly truly inspirational. He's got told that he was going to be affected by Agent Orange, and he is. His kids have suffered from it. He was at Camp Lejeune, so he's affected by Camp Lejeune water thing. And the only thing Jack Riley's done in his life is give to people. He is one of the great inspirations to me in doing this. And I tell the story, and when I talk about when I introduce post-traumatic winning, I use a quote. I talk about what they're going to hear today is only the truth. There's not one ounce of bullshit in this whole thing. And this truth comes from our Marine Corps culture. It comes from the interviews I've done here for, 3.5 years now. And, well into the fourth year. And out of that truth, I've taken that and distilled it into this 3 goals and 9 commandments of post-traumatic winning. But, if I footnoted them, there'd be names next to every piece of that. It's not my wisdom. It's our wisdom from our culture, and it applies to everybody, and it's what I love about it. And so I say, and then I put this my fake Kanye West quote up, right? That is actually my quote, and the quote comes to me as I'm interviewing Jack Riley. I don't know if I was interviewing him live or if I was editing the interview and just listening to it, but that's where that thing the truth lands with a thud and needs no salesman. That's when that comes up. And so I do the little bit about Kanye West, and then I look at him and I put a slide up, and it's a picture of Jack. And I say, you're not even going to understand what I'm going to say right now, okay? But just listen to me. When he came over Vietnam, there was no internet, right? So how does he find his guys? How does he get word to them? How does he get them together? Well, he started searching for them, right? Started looking for them. And writing letters and, but people move. So the address that you have written in pen or pencil in your platoon sergeant's notebook or your squad leader's notebook may not still be the same good address. And you're trying to find somebody. And so he wrote to states and to companies to get their DOS floppy disks of their phone book so he could find his guys. Right? He organized reunions to get his guys back together. When that was an extremely difficult task. And then he's gone through his life wherever he can, helping. And so he's lived this incredible life, I think, of service. And he's just a good dude. You hear him every day, well, goodness, Mike, right? Now, that's goodness. Although it's 2 syllables, it's not 2 separate words, okay? So Al, he speaks his own... with his own proud Alabama tongue. And, no, he's just a great guy. And I called him yesterday, talked to him. And, so you're gonna hear Jack Riley again today. All right. And so, but Jack Riley lives in post-traumatic winning. right? He lives in post-traumatic way. And that quote, you know, well, I am disabled, but we can't live like that. You know, he's a living, breathing example of what post-traumatic winning is about. And let me tell you this, what even more significant, not only the examples of what we all should be, but the reason, right, that Jack learned what I learned, that Libby taught me, Tsunami Lady taught me, right? Bob Nielsen did the same thing, right? They both very independently, like I did, discover the truth of Viktor Frankl, what Frankl discovers in concentration camps, okay? And that is, you can transform tremendous pain in your life if you'll give to others. So Jack does that, right? And so it's his inoculation, right? Not inoculation isn't the right word, because inoculation, you have to get it. For instance, Sergeant Doe, he got inoculated with post-traumatic winning. Okay, and what happened was Sergeant Doe got to class, did not have trauma in his life, and then when his father commits suicide, right, the inoculation is in him, and he knows. He knows what to do. And he told me that. So he's inoculated, right? Riley already has it. He has the disease, so you can't inoculate him with it. But what he discovered was what Frankl discovered. And that is that he could overwhelm his traumatic experience with joyful experience if he gave to other people and helped other people. And so that act of giving in and itself becomes its own drug. It becomes how you cope with it, is that you give of yourself. And in that giving, right, you create this joy in your life that overwhelms the trauma. So that even though the trauma exists, you don't feel it. And that's what Bob Nielsen done, right? I mean, you listen to Bob talk. I mean, he started helping Marines get jobs when he was acting as a liaison officer at the VA, you know, at the VA at a naval hospital in Boston, I think, maybe Boston, I'm not sure. And so he had screwed his leg up, so he was helping guys find jobs. That back in the early 70s. And he hasn't stopped his whole life. Well, why hasn't he stopped? Because he's an altruistic guy? And no. Very selfishly, Bob deals with his shit by giving to other people. And buying them pizza. Yeah, he gives them pizza. But the pizza's not that good. But the feeling, that drug, right? So Jack Riley and Bob Nielsen, you know, discovers what Frankl discovers, what Libby taught me. And that is, we are all crack whores, right, for touching other people, right, for changing their lives, for mitigating their pain, right, because of what it does for us. So at the end, is it a selfish act? You know, no, it's not selfish. It's unselfish because you know the truth. But do you derive benefits of it? Without a doubt, right? If it was a miserable experience, they wouldn't. Well, maybe they would continue to do it if it was the right thing to do. They'd both probably do it. But the overwhelming feeling that you get is amazing. So, Robbie's going to join us. Should I play the national anthem now? No. Well, yeah. Let me play the national anthem, and then I'll do the weather, and then I'll play this audio that I want you to hear them talking about how they reached the conclusions. And I want you specifically to listen to two things. One is the percentages of people, and they're screening. They're most concerned with depression. Okay, so that's what they're looking for in the population. Right, so you're going to hear about that. There's a study they're doing in Texas called Vital Signs 6. Okay, so that's what they're doing. And then the other thing I want you to listen to that is going to surprise you is how they've come to identify people that can be quality workers in the mental health care field. And it'll surprise you. And it's not what you think either. So, good morning to you. Welcome to All Marine Radio on a Wednesday. The United States Marine Corps Band makes it official. Good morning. Dedicated to everybody out there listening, in the hope that when you listen to this audio here in a few minutes, that it will impact you, it will change the way that you feel about mental health, that you'll see it as another component of physical health and well-being, and not be afraid to touch people's lives, not be afraid to go there. And so this is dedicated to all of you, and oh, by the way, it includes Jack Riley. And you'll hear him right after a human being says, "Well, goodness, Mike."
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
If you don't love your Marines, then you really ought to get out. The only reason I stuck around that low paying outfit for 40 years is for the absolute pleasure of serving alongside cocky, rambunctious, disciplined, selfless, unbelievably selfless young Marine. And the infantry got its name, infantry young soldier. And I enjoyed being around them. And in the military, it's all about the team. And so if you don't know the team players beyond simply their rank and last name, you don't care about them deeply. I mean, just go up to Bethesda any time you want to see the cost of war and see the ranks on the rooms that you're walking into. Lance Corporal here, Lance Corporal there, PFC here, Sergeant there, Lieutenant. If you don't care about these guys, don't expect them to care about what's important to you. They're putting their lives on the line.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah. He goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, we'll check the weather. Raining in 61 in Quantico, where the Washington Nationals swept the St. Louis Cardinals last night. Yeah, pandemonium breaking out. The Nationals, they're good. And if they play the Astros in the World Series, you're going to see a matchup of pitching, starting pitchers in particular, that is just like, it's like Mothra versus Godzilla, right? Yeah, guys are behemoth. Some of the best pitchers, I would say this, the best pitchers in Major League Baseball will square off. Yeah, so, and I don't, honestly, I don't see, I'm a Yankee fan, I don't see the Yankees beating Houston. Houston's got, I mean, the two guys, so what has to happen is, Yankees got to beat Gerrit Cole, or who's 19-0 since May, or Justin Verlander, who's right behind him. They've got to beat one of those two guys, and they've got to beat Zach Greinke again, and then whoever else Houston throws. So they've got to beat those two guys, and then they've got to beat one of those two to go to the World Series. So that's tall order. It's tall order, because those guys are good. Like I said, Gerrit Cole is on a run of Major League Baseball historic proportions. They said the last guy who's had a run like this was like some, if you're a baseball history fan, you'll know this, but somebody like Knapp LaJoie, you know, in 1912, you know, went, I don't know, 23-0 in a stretch. So it's amazing. And but yeah, last night in the nation's capital. But it's raining there now. Raining on the East Coast. Yankee Astro game tonight in doubt. Cloudy in 71, Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune. 66 degrees and 29 palms under sunny skies. 65 at Camp Pendleton. Camp Smith in Hawaii, dark cloudy 72. Okinawa, dark cloudy 77. In the Al Anbar province of Iraq, dark cloudy and 87. In the Helmand province of Afghanistan, clear, dark, and 69. At the home of All Marine Radio, here in the Costa Mesa Newport Beach area of Southern California, it is cloudy and 61. Looking for a high of upper 70s today. So that is a look at your weather. Now, we're not going to take a break right now because I got something to say. But I want to play this audio that you're going to hear. And it was done, it's from the Community Mental Health Care of University Texas Southwest, I think in Dallas. So anyway, they put on a forum about community-based mental health. And so you're going to hear Dr. Patel he's at the microphone right now. So here he is, and he's talking about community-based mental health. And I want to play this for you because, you know, we need to dispel some myths that, like, only the PhDs have a say, because I'm getting sick of this shit. Because let me tell you what you see in the DOD. What you see in the DOD and the VA is the PhD have had a say. And guess what? The problem's only getting fucking worse, and I'm not buying their bullshit anymore. Like, oh, well, you just don't know the impact, because if it wasn't for us, it would be a lot worse. Okay, let me just tell you this. You're fired. Okay? We're going to get somebody in here who's going to speak their language on their frequency, who's going to reach them, and we're going to make that number go the other way. So I don't want to hear what you have to fucking say anymore. And you've gone, you haven't performed. You've used that excuse for decades, and I'm not buying that bullshit anymore. All right, so with all that said, here you go.
So your question was really about what can the global north learn from the developing world. First of all, I have to say, as far as mental health is concerned, I don't think any country can be considered to be developed. I think every country is developing, and certainly everything I've read about the U.S. in terms of its mental health care system strikes me as being not that dissimilar in some respects in terms of lack of access to care, but also more fundamental issues to do with people with mental health problems living on the streets and in prisons. So I think there is a lot that both sides of the world can learn from each other. And for me, the most important opportunity that has come from the developing world is the very large acceptance of frontline workers. That is to say, community-based workers who are employed by or incentivized by the formal healthcare system, who provide interventions for a whole range of health problems, not just mental health. All that I've done is taken an established approach for a variety of other health problems and applied it to mental health. These are ordinary people with specific task-based training who then operate as outreach workers of the healthcare system and provide support to people with health problems in their own homes and in their own communities. And I think that this might be an approach that might have some value in even a highly resourced specialized setting such as the U.S. And I'll just finish by saying that incredibly, this approach already is existing here in some parts of the country, as, for example, in the state of Washington. And just last week, I got a message from the chief of Thrive New York City, which is a billion-dollar investment by the mayor to improve mental health care in the city of New York, saying he was really excited that the word TAR shifting, which is something we use in global health for poor countries, had actually been used by the mayor as his vision for mental health care in New York City. So maybe that kind of reverse engineering is already happening.
And one of the things that might be helpful is to talk a little bit about what you've done, because I don't know how many people have had a chance to see your TED Talk, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how I think it was very interesting in ground rounds. Just previously you were talking about how you solicited these special people within your community, which...
This is Julie. She's the moderator.
You know, I was thinking, oh, there must have been a special screening process. You maybe looked for all these indicators of who it should be, and then you had a much more simple solution that was very direct. And so why don't you talk about that?
Well, I started off thinking that you needed a special kind of person to deliver mental health care, and therefore we had a very special procedure right at the start of when we began this kind of work about 10 or 15 years ago. So this involved, for example, getting people to do role plays in front of a panel of three mental health professionals who would then rate you on a variety of things like did the person show empathy and did the person, you know, did he have listening skills and so on and so forth, which is a traditional way in which you assess psychotherapeutic skills. We kind of realized very quickly that this was very laborious and also not very accurate. And so instead we just abandoned any kind of screening and simply put an ad in the papers and said, are you interested in working with people with mental health problems in the community? And if you showed up to the door, then presumably you had some kind of interest at least, some kind of calling. And that to us was sufficient as an entry criterion. Then you entered into a period of brief training followed by supervised work that ultimately led you to graduate into a qualified community-based mental health worker.
And Dr.
So interesting, right? they rejected this credentialed systemic approach designed, you know, to include people who shouldn't be working in this field. And that what they found was if they found people that were passionate and willing to work, that they could teach them, right? Holy shit. Holy shit. And that's what they did? So to me, that's very interesting, right? It goes on.
Dr. Trivedi, can you talk a little bit? I'm not sure everybody in the community is familiar with the two major projects that you're working with, Vital Sign 6, where you're working with 19 primary care clinics.
Okay, now that you're going to hear Dr. Trivedi, okay, and he's going to talk. You're going to hear him say some stuff about, I think his first name's Madagar. The Indian names kind of throw me. And he's going to talk about, you know, some of the stuff he's done relative to numbers that have come out of this study he's doing. And I think the study is based on software programs that they've written that help general practitioners screen symptoms and log symptoms for patients every visit that are constantly looking for symptoms of depression. Because the way you stop depression is you catch it in its infancy, and then you teach people the coping skills how to coexist with it. Yeah, you have these things in you, but if you do these things, and so listen to what he says, and listen to the numbers that he says, which to me is part of the basis, the intellectual basis for post-traumatic learning
in Dallas, and also the Risk and Resilience Network in Teens. One of the reasons why I really was so excited about having both these men on stage together today is they are really doing very similar work in a lot of ways. And Dr. Trivedi is doing this through the primary care environment and through high schools. Dr. Patel is actually even going deeper into the community, I think, by having outreach community members spread out throughout the community. But I think ultimately this is the same, we're attacking the same issues and providing sort of a tiered base level of care so that it's easy to access, it's not intimidating, and people can get the help they need. So Dr. Trivedi, why don't you talk a little bit about the two main projects you're working with?
Now, interesting, huh? Easy to access, not intimidating. Interesting. Mental health care like that? Really? Well, that's interesting. Does such a thing even exist? Because everything I've ever been told, you know, it's way too complicated for rubes like us to understand and help with.
Thank you. And thank you, first, for all of you coming in. I think, as Dr. Patel said, and Julie's heard me say this many, many times, I think we will continue to do research and write those papers and more of them, as long as they keep me here. But the biggest impact to change this equation in our field is going to come from you. The community has to want it and has to be engaged. So I am so pleased all of you are here. We can't do this without really the community involved. So what Julie is saying is, what we are interested in the following. So now 35 years since, or 40 years since antidepressants started really becoming routinely used, and antidepressant psychotherapies are being available that are very well documented to be effective, and ECT and transmagnetic stimulation, a number of treatments available in the world and in the United States, and yet, outcomes for our patients as a general population have not improved. And so what is the problem? So first thing we wanted to address was really 85% of people with depression in the United States never see a mental health professional in their entire lives. They really are being taken care of in various ways in primary care settings. They are pediatricians when they are young. They are primary care physicians. They are obstetricians if they are women. And they never get into mental health care. So we wanted to really start there. So that's why the network was started in primary care. And we have basically introduced something that is called measurement-based care. So if you want to diagnose and treat depression, you have to measure. And unfortunately, my field has done a disservice. We have not really enforced the idea that you have to measure what you're doing, otherwise you don't know where you're going. So we have developed a software called Vital Sign 6. These primary care practices, over the last just 1 year, have now screened 40,000 patients. And we have created a very elegant triage system that allows us to really answer the question of right patient, right treatment at the right place. So that those patients who are really started in treatment in primary care, they actually get diagnosed, they get measured, and their treatment happens in primary care. When that is not sufficient and they need a mental health specialist, then we provide the arrangement to refer them to the right place. In that system has actually been phenomenally effective, and some of our partners are here in the audience. So that's the first part, is to really improve the access to care and improve outcomes for patients with the treatments we currently have available. But we know that that's not going to be sufficient. There are really research questions that need to be asked to address, to understand developing new treatments, and that is the second part of what we are doing here at UT Southwestern in terms of developing new treatments. And based on both of these things, we have actually launched a large project like the Framingham study for depression, where we are identifying 2,500 people with depression and really going to develop blood and brain tests. Because one of the major problems in our field is because there is not a lab test, people feel like maybe that's not real. And so we are really very seriously focused on developing research ideas in order to do that. And that's and it's already started paying off. We just published a paper where a protein called C-reactive protein, if we measure that, then we can actually improve the outcomes of patients if you match that protein assessment with the right treatment by 30%. So therefore, we are really beginning to do that already, and that's the second part of this. And that is all designed to try to improve the quality of care, improve outcomes, and then develop these tests so that in 5 years, people will not be wondering what treatment should I get. They'll get a blood test or a brain test, and we can begin to match patients with treatments. It will not lead to treatment matching for 100% of patients, but I think we will be profoundly farther along than we have been for the last 30 years. And then the final, which is the Risk and Resilience Network, and our work in high schools and middle schools, is the following. Most of advances...
Okay, the Risk and Resilience Network in high school and middle schools. All right, so listen.
...in medicine, cancers, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, et cetera, have really ultimately come from prevention and early recognition and not wait. What we currently do for depression is really wait until somebody has stage 4 breast cancer and then start treatment. The time between when the patient has the first symptoms and the first treatment is 10 to 12 years. We would not tolerate this in any field of medicine, diabetes, hypertension, colon cancer, anything. In depression, the community and us all accept it, and we have to change it. So that's sort of the focus of our work, is we have to change this, and the only way to change it is to be in the community and not wait for patients to come to the ivory tower. Therefore, our interest in going to community primary care practices. These practices actually that we are in, some of them are, like I said, are here. They were not actually officially affiliated with UT Southwestern. They were independent primary care practices, and that is really how we have started. We are expanding it. Some of my partners from other parts are here. We'll go to pediatric clinics eventually, and I think that is sort of the goal of this.
Hold on to the microphone. Can everybody hear me if I speak loudly enough? So hold on, because I'm going to do a little follow-on to this. So you're not escaping the microphone. So one of the things that I found really interesting in this 40,000 people that you have surveyed, you found fairly consistently.
Now, this is the part that I include in post-traumatic winning. Okay, so listen to the numbers of the study, the numbers of people that ping for depression, symptoms of depression, and then the number of people. Now, remind you, this is in the general population, right, with everybody, the sick, lame, and crazy. It's not a screened and culled population like that exists in the military.
About 15% having depression, correct? And so talk a little bit about the triage that you're finding of how much you can actually care for two things. I don't think people maybe realize from what you just said, when do you measure? Like, do you just wait for people to say, oh, I'm depressed? Or how do you measure? And two, how much of that 15% actually end up having to go to a psychiatrist?
So one thing, like at the end of this exercise today and maybe in the next 2-3 years, I want all of you to be actually as informed as Julie is about all this. She is absolutely right. So our screening is really universal screening. What traditionally happens in primary care is people wait and the patient either complains or starts crying or is suicidal is when they screen. That is not called screening because then it's too late. So what this is, we are primary care practices are universally screening. Every patient coming into the clinic gets screened for depression, and that is how you identify whether they need to have further monitoring or not. And that is the 12 to 15% of patients. Once they get screened positive, then they get routine measurement at every treatment occasion to monitor their outcomes. And if the patients have significant need for psychiatry, they are referred, and that has been really less than 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. Because there is, like hypertension, nobody actually, or headache, imagine if for headache everybody wanted to go to see a neurosurgeon, you couldn't find any. That is what we do with depression. Instead, what we are changing the paradigm so that most patients who can be treated in primary care get treated there, and then those who need to go to psychiatry or psychotherapy, then they go there. And we've also created teletherapy modules and other things to envelop all this. But as a result, we are actually leaving patients in the right place and getting the right treatment without having to run around to find a psychiatrist.
All right. So if you do the math on that, 44,000 people in this study, and 12 to 15% ping for 12 to 15% ping for symptoms of depression. 11 to 14%. So depending if the number is 12, then 11 of the 12% are treated by a general practitioner. If the number is 15%, 14 of that 15%. So so what is that as a percentage? So among the people that ping for depression in this study, 14 divided by 15 equals 93% of them can be dealt with by general practitioners. And what do general practitioners talk to them about? Diet, exercise, disclosure, talking about it, right? Alcohol consumption. And sleep. Now, every one of us can do that. And that's one of the things we talk about in post-traumatic winning. So the premise of this is if you look at the population, right, and only 1% in terms of depression requires a mental health professional, everybody else can be seen by, you know, now that advice about diet, exercise, disclosure, about talking about it, about sleep and alcohol consumption, That can be given by any one of us can do that. And general practitioners, they spend how many minutes with you when they see you? It's not more than 10, I can tell you that. Well, all of us, a lot of us spend a lot more time with people that we're concerned about than that, and we do that on a regular basis. So to me, that's the good news in all of this. And that, you know, and the reason I played that was this whole notion of, you know, that mental health belongs to that group is bullshit. Is bullshit. It should be a layered approach with a whole bunch of people that are concerned, that can talk to people about the basic things that have been proven, right, to deal with 99% of the population. Now, I would tell you, relative to, you know, the military, of that 12 to 15%, what percent of that can get through the screening and then recruit training and not, I mean, I would say not too much of that. If you have any of those issues, you know, it's going to come out when you're sequestered and you're stressed. And so we tend not to deal with that. And so, again, good news on top of that. That means that the problem in the military is fixable. 99% of it is sure as shit fixable. And what it's an indictment of, and this is the sad reality. It's an indictment of leadership, disengaged and distant leadership. And that's what has to I have to write that down. That's actually sounded good, right? I wrote it down. Disengaged and distant leadership. That creates the vacuum in which bad things happen. And then we're even, you know, chicken shit enough to say, but call the 800 number if you feel like you're going to do this. But we don't know you. So, let me go through a few news headlines. But I wanted to share that with you. I think that's important stuff. Right? Community-based mental health is important stuff. And the more I read, the more I study, the more I hear that stuff, the more I absolutely, positively, believe that it is the right thing. So with that said, a few news stories before we get to Jack Riley here at the top of the hour. There's a panel at the Army's doing their AUSA annual meeting in Washington, D.C., right? Now, the Marine Corps does modern-day Marine down in Quantico. The Army, man, this thing is the biggest thing you've ever seen in your life. And they're in their pink and greens on stage. Got the Sergeant Major of the Army, and let's see, who's this? Army Chief of Staff General James McConville. Center speaks at the... Okay, at the event. So anyway, he says, look, moving people every 3 years is an antiquated way of doing business. Quote, I don't see why people can't stay 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, McConville said Tuesday during a town hall held at the Association of U.S. Army annual meeting in D.C. Quote, part of the future that we see in the talent management system is we do look at preferences. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? If we can accommodate that, longer tours, why shouldn't we? The Army's current approach, where most soldiers move every 3 to 5 years, was a product of the industrial age personal management system, he said. He went on, I don't sign up for that. I sign up for making less moves or stabilizing people longer, but we're not going to have the soldier moving in March and the kids getting pulled out of school. So I think it's interesting. If you couple that with something that the Commandant of the Marine Corps said recently, and that is how we deliver education. The way we deliver education is antiquated. Okay? Now, we may have an annual school for a small group, but everybody else, you know, the numbers say that only 20% of the captains of the Marine Corps go to a formal school. That's bad. That's bad, and it's bad for the Marines they lead. So how do we fix that? How do we deliver high-quality distance learning? How do we do that? So I think these things are being looked at. I think it's great. Next headline. I can't even look at the atrocities. Some U.S. troops say the Syria withdrawal is a betrayal of an ally. Let me read you a quote. I look at the events, and it stands out to me as so representative of the sacrifice that the Kurds made in the fight against ISIS. It's just one of many instances where they show that type of bravery. The very next day, they were right back at it, and this had to do after an IED blew up a bunch of guys, and our special forces guys were using their medical skills to save people. And then the next day, they were right back fighting about it. Quote, it feels like we were abandoning our closest ally in the fight against ISIS, and we're abandoning them to a fate that is going to end very poorly for them. To completely abandon a force that has given thousands of lives for this conflict is really tough to watch. And then they talked about watching some of the videos they've seen about the executions and stuff like that. I can't even watch the videos. The ISIS mission is going to stop. ISIS is going to have a resurgence, and we're going to have to go back there in 5 years and do it all again. I remember hearing, quote, how are we going to phrase terms to convince Trump not to go off the cliff? It's like, how do you steer him in the right direction and not where he wants to go? Another Army officer who deployed to Syria a few times has knowledge of the ongoing operations, predicted in an interview Saturday that if the United States didn't change policy within 48 hours, everything over the last 5 years is done within hours. Trump ordered the removal of all Americans from Syria. Quote, folks are heartbroken, the second officer said. It's very different than if we had said we're getting out of Syria in 6 months. Reasonable man definition says that we facilitated the attack. If someone had presented Trump with a six-month withdrawal plan and actually stuck to it, we wouldn't be having these conversations, the soldier said. You can tell me horror stories and show me the intel reports, and none of it would matter to me. I fully support withdrawing from Syria. Our collective reality in Syria tried to explain it to them. You can't do that. If you do that, it puts us in a very precarious position, and we're providing unparalleled and unequaled support from the air. But they still did it. So, anyway. Update on where the fleet is. The amphibious group centered around the Bataan and the Kursaj, which is, I believe, the 31st Mew. No. That's not. That's an East Coast Mew. They're in port or off the coast of Norfolk. The USS Wasp is down in Latinum, is off the west coast of, I believe that looks like Chile. Yes. The carrier strike group, Ronald Reagan, it looks to be transiting the Malaccan Straits. The carrier strike group, Abraham Lincoln, is on station in the North Arabian Sea. And the Boxer amphibious ready, ARG, amphibious ready group, is... looks like off the west coast of Taiwan. So that's a little update on where people are. A couple of stories. This is from the Associated Press. Fearing American abandonment, Kurds kept back channels open to both Damascus and Moscow, and they kept them wide open. In fact, the move had been in the works for more than a year. Fearing U.S. abandonment, the Kurds opened a back channel to the Syrian government and the Russians in 2018, and those talks ramped up significantly in recent weeks. Quote, we warn the Kurds the Americans will ditch them, Russian ambassador to the European Union, Vladimir Chizov, told Russia's TASS news agency on Monday. It's awesome to read that, isn't it? The next article, interesting. Chow Hall makeover. Color-coded food, greens up front. Here's the plan to get soldiers and Marines eating better. If you've noticed any subtle changes in your chow hall or the plated offerings in the mess buffet getting a little greener, You have a team of scientists and soldiers at a branch of the Army Research in New England, Natick to be exact, to thank for that. Efforts are underway in the Army and the Marine Corps dining facilities to shrink the piece of pie troops shoved down at chow hall and increase the nutritious food that's going to help them recover and perform better on the battlefield. The programs Green for Green in the Army and Fuel to Fight in the Marine Corps have already nudged troops towards eating nearly 5% in the right direction over the past 2 years. They've separated food choices within the 2800 recipe catalog of the DOD into red, yellow, and green categories. Red, check fire. Foods are likely delicious, but should be limited, likely high in fat and can decrease performance. Think cakes, desserts, and other classic junk food. Yellow, well-aimed shots is the title of it. The category of foods are good for you and can make up as a little less than half of the plate, but often have higher total fat and saturated fats. Green, engage at will. Foods are the best, most nutritious, and should make up nearly half your plate more if possible. Green foods are low in sugar, high in fiber, have healthy fats, and include plant-based protein and leaner cuts of beef. How about that? Health comes to the military. Top five stories in Early Bird. One, Ergodin says Turkey will never declare a ceasefire. So there you have that. That's from CNN. And number two, Russian and Syrian troops fill a void as the U.S. pulls out of Syria. That's from the Military Times. Number three, U.S. Special Operations secrets could fall into hands of Russians and Syrians in pullout. How would that happen? Well, electronic devices that have videos, that have documents, that have other things, some stuff that possibly left behind, would be prime targets for anybody. And again, make no mistake, it's not like the Kurds who are around don't know the value of that stuff. And they would take it to somebody and say, hey, I have something that you might be interested in. Why? Because somebody will get paid money. Number four, how night court will impact the Pentagon acquisition office. Not interested in it. Number five, U.S. carried out secret cyber strike on Iran in the wake of the Saudi oil attack, according to officials. I'll go into that a different time because I'm always interested in cyber warfare, but I am Jack Riley waiting for me patiently. Turkey, Syria, headlines. I'll just read the headlines, right? House to vote on resolution rebuking Trump, Syria's troop pullout. Second, money, hatred for the Kurds drives Turkey, Syrian fighters. Video shows inside of an abandoned U.S. camp in Syria taken over by Russian mercenaries. Next headline, I can't even look at the atrocities. U.S. troops say Trump, Syria withdrawal betrayed an ally. Next one, Kurdish fighters mount counterattack using networks of tunnels. Next headline, U.S. troops express anger at Trump's Syria policy. We betrayed the Kurds. Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo heading to Turkey as Russia moves to fill the void left by the U.S. You know, let me just tell you this. The whole Pence and Pompeo headed to Turkey, it, to me, is a joke, right? I would look at the Americans and the way, we conducted ourselves over there and say, get out of here, man. You guys are ass clowns. Yeah, you guys are like total shitheads. You can't do anything right. So, anyway, that's just me. I could be wrong. I'm probably not. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jack Riley's going to join us. So, don't touch that dial. He's a great guy. It'll be an interesting conversation no matter what we talk about. Don't go away. More Bowman Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.